طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Today we take a long look at the steady process of annexation that Israel is imposing on Palestine, which is accelerating as we speak. We feature Kristen McCarthy of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in a conversation with Shira Livni of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel about all things annexation, including how annexation is related to the current judicial reforms and what annexation looked like previous to the current government. How significant are the changes in governance that the current government has taken? Here is Shira Livni and Kristen McCarthy.
On this episode, we are going to dive deep into Israeli annexation of West Bank land, which is an underappreciated motivating force of the authors and champions of the pro-judicial reform movement. We're going to tackle what annexation has looked like previous to the current government and the recent transformations that have fueled the acceleration of annexation in a myriad of ways. I'm so, so glad to be joined by Shira Livni today. Shira is the Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, the director of the Unit for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories at ACRI, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. Shira holds a BA in History and Political Science from Tel Aviv University and a Master's in Conflict Resolution from Georgetown University. Shira, thank you so, so much for joining us today for this podcast. I know everyone's so busy doing a million things, and it really means a lot that you've taken the time today to help us unpack annexation.
Happy to, and thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's first set the scene. Can you give us just a brief recap of the legal status of the West Bank? And for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to set aside Gaza and East Jerusalem. So what is the legal status of the West Bank under international law? I know Israel has maintained a military occupation of that land via its military, not its domestic governmental bodies like the Knesset, and the Prime Minister's office, and yada, yada. The Israeli government, its courts, and for the most part, its elected officials have until recently refrained from passing laws and legal decisions which bring the occupied territories under its direct rule, which would be de jure annexation. So what do we need to understand about this legal framework of occupation in order to understand annexation? So feel free to add to that very, very brief framework, which I think is just an important starting place for this conversation.
So let's start talking about occupation, all right? So legally, occupation is a neutral phrase, if you will, right, or expression. It basically says that military occupation or belligerent occupation, right, whatever you want to refer to, is describing a situation on the ground after usually a war or any kind of military conflict when a certain power or a state, right, apply military rule or regime over a territory that it conquered after or during the conflict, right? And since the military, the occupying force, sees the residents of the occupied territory as enemies and vice versa, they see the army as the enemy as well, the international law basically had certain principles that apply in order to make sure that situation of occupation is done with certain limitation in an illegal fashion, right? And when we're talking about occupation or the law of occupation, if you will, we have three main principles or rules, if you will, and that is that the first of all, trust check, right? The occupied territory is being held as a trust by the occupier, and that force have to kind of run that territory or govern the territory as somebody that his role or its role is to protect the basic welfare and interests of the local population, the ones who've been there before and consider protected, while balancing their interest or welfare with the security needs of the occupying force within that territory, right? That is the first very important principle. The second one says it's temporality, as they call it in, judicial language. It's a temporary situation. Once the need to occupy the land will be over because we resolve whatever conflict there was, it will be done, right? And the third one that is pretty much the result of the first two is that because it's a trust chip and it's temporary, then the occupied force cannot apply sovereignty. In other words, it can annex the land, right? Because annexation is a one-sided move that doesn't take into consideration the rights, interests of the protected population. So basically, that's the situation of an occupation, okay? The occupier is the trustee, the temporary trustee of the territory, and can't have one-sided sovereignty over the land. Because of those kind of basic principles, if you will, there are certain prohibitions, right? Certain limitations. The main one, usually considered to be that you can't, as the occupying power, you can't transfer your own population into the occupied territory, right? That is one of the most basic no-nos of occupation. Why? Right? Because the international law understands that when you move your own population into a territory, what will happen is that you will start as the governor of the land, you would start to prefer their interests because they're your people. Right? It's a very natural kind of assumption, and this is why you are not supposed to transfer your own population into the occupied territory, right? And this is why you also don't suppose you are not allowed to annex, because then you will apply your own interest to that territory that was not yours, and that will add towards a kind of, a land incentive. Wars are not will not just be about dispute over maybe territorial lines or whatever infractions, but they will also be about land grabbing, and that was something that the international law kind of tried to stop in a way. I won't say successfully, but try. Right. So this is the basic framework that we have in terms of occupation and what does it mean in the international law. But then we have to ask yourself, how is Israel interpreting that whole situation, right? So we would say that according to international community, according, to the international law community and so forth, the situation in the West Bank is a situation of occupation, very straightforward, right? The international law applied and really not a lot of question. But since the beginning of the occupation, 1967, Israel has kind of applied, let's say, a vagueness policy, right? In a sense of what is the legal status of the West Bank? Israel was it's complicated. Basically saying that the territory of the land, the West Bank, is a liberated territory because it was never a part of another state before. Right? And this is why Israel doesn't recognize the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention, the one that is kind of specifying or detailing the rules of occupation we just talked about, including, of course, the prohibition to move your own population into the occupied territory. Mm-hmm. I would say then, just to kind of add another complex into an already complex situation, that the Israeli court did recognize the fact that Israel have what we call belligerent occupation over the territories, right? And the international law applied in that case. But the official policy is like, it's complicated.
Well, I think it's you're bringing up so many interesting points, because there's how international law theoretically speaks to what's happening in the West Bank. And then there's how Israel is like, not, I mean, it's implementing it not in the way that international law says, but not to give Israel credit, there are ways that Israel, to your point, that the courts have said this is a belligerent occupation. The status quo for many, many years in Israel has been that the West Bank is under a military occupation, that it's military rules that place. And of course, there's exceptions, and it's not as, nothing's as clear and easy as that. But there has been this infrastructure of governance separate from the Israeli governments that's dealt with the West Bank and Gaza. And that's part of what's changing right now. There's this bureaucratic transformation that's happening to kind of make it, the Israeli government, sovereign over the whole territory, and to kind of deconstruct the infrastructure of occupation government. But I want to get to that second. First, I have to ask you, you started talking about how Israel has not fulfilled their international legal obligations over the West Bank. You started talking about settlements and transferring their domestic population to the West Bank. Tell me more. What has annexation, de facto annexation, and maybe you can explain de facto de jure. I know you're not a lawyer, but just a brief summary.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. What has annexation looked like up until, say, earlier this year when the new government started all of these radical transformations?
Right. So very basically, right, like there's a whole kind of a legal debate about annexation. I won't go into it because honestly, it's like a whole new process. But basically, de jure annexation is official annexation. It's an official declaration by the Israeli government that is like applying its sovereignty over the West Bank, Area C. We don't know exactly what they want, right? And of course, always remember when we're talking about the West Bank, we're also including the Jordan Valley there, right? Which always the prime candidate to be first to be annexed. And the de facto annexation basically mean like practical or on-the-ground annexation, right? Stuff that happens by changing how the reality is looking on the ground, changing the policy that is being implemented without officially declaring it, right? And that is something that has been going on for quite a while, right? For at least, I think we can say a decade, if not more. Some will say from the beginning of the occupation, it's kind of, you know, up for debate. But we can say that basically from the start of the occupation, Israel policy a lot of the time was like establishing facts on the ground, not necessarily declaring them out loud, right? Because Israel has always been tried to kind of toe the line between what is our interest in that area in sense of like our stronghold over it, and we wanted to be like a greater stronghold on it, most of all, because of security reasons, but also because territorial reasons, not to mention natural resources, but also very aware of the fact that there is international scrutiny. There is international pressure and criticism with regard to what are you doing with this territory that we don't think that belongs to you. But we definitely have seen in the last few years more and more attempt to kind of push forward those steps of what is being referred to as creeping annexation, de facto annexation, annexation is smooth. Everyone chooses their own kind of term, right? But basically what we're seeing is more and more attempt by the Israeli government to push forward a policy that is strengthening Israel control over the land, right? Expanding the settlement enterprise, and basically creating a situation that is no longer temporary, right? Remember our first principle, temporality. And we are kind of, you know, eroding that situation. Obviously, one of the most gross violations is establishing the settlements, because as we said, you are not supposed to do it according to international law, because they perpetuate and establish the Israeli law hold over the territories and creating a situation, as we started talking, that the land is not held in a trustship for the benefit of the protected population, the Palestinian, but the military regime actually act. Its official policy is to prefer the interests, both political and civilian interests, of the residents, of the Israeli residents, right, of the residents of the occupying power. And you can see it, you know, like in almost every YouTube that you will see Palestinian documenting soldiers asking them, what you're doing here, when we're like seeing settlers around, they will say, we're protecting the settlers, right? And that is like the most, you know, basic thing that you can say, well, something is very wrong here because it's not how this is supposed to work. But I will also say this is not the only way that Israel is pushing forward with what we call creeping annexation or annexation, however you want to call it, right? Another part of it is that those settlements are not under the military law, right? Palestinians in the occupied territory in Area C are all under the military law. This is the law that they have to follow in their daily life. Settlements and the settlers are actually what the law that is applied to them is the Israeli law, right? That was being enforced through military orders that basically said, created those kind of, you know, if you will, bubbles of Israeli, let's say, mini sovereignty or personal sovereignty, basically creating a situation where each settler kind of, you know, goes around surrounded in a halo of the Israeli law with all the rights that giving them. So you have a situation where you have two law systems on the same territory already, right? One with all the protection and the right given to a person with a full political status, and the other one is a military regime, very restrictive and very oppressive. Another very clear step, an actionish step, if you will, is pushing out Palestinian residents from Area C, right, in order to kind of strengthen the Israeli hold. So you're pushing out the protected residents. You do it by land planning. You do it by the refusal to issue building permits, by demolitions, by preventing access to water, to land, by closing a lot of land with military order. Not to mention that you also kind of strengthening your hold on the land when you use its natural resources. It's mining, it's water, all this kind of stuff. And you do it not for the interest of the protected population, but for your own. So you can see settlements and settlers and the application of Israeli law over them. You can see that displacement or the pushing out of Palestinians through various bureaucratic means, right? Oh, it's always like under the guise of the law, right? But it's also a policy. You will not give a permit as easily to a Palestinian and you give it to a settler. You know, the numbers are amazing when you look at them, like when you compare the numbers of what Palestinians get with Palestinians. And it's done also by using the resources of the land to your own kind of, you know, your own benefit.
Excellent. Detailed description. I think there are so many facets of what annexation has looked like that are not fully appreciated. Sometimes we just think of the settlement or the outpost, but it's the discriminatory building policies, which I hope to get to later. You know, roads, road construction, transportation, annexation, exactly. The growth of industrial zones, the checkpoints, the separation barrier, of course, is a huge one that, you know, mm-hmm. doesn't enough attention as it should these days. So there's so many things, but I want to ask you, and again, this is not to give credit to Israel for anything, but what have, up until this year, what has been the limitations on Israeli annexation or aspirations for annexation? And here I'm thinking, you know, of the Oslo Accords and how the West Bank has been divided under the Oslo Accords into three areas, A, B, and C, with C being 61% of the West Bank, where Israel retained, was given by the Oslo Accords civilian and security control over an area, B and A being more where Palestinians live in their areas. So how does the Oslo Accord kind of talk to us about what Israeli annexation has been limited by over the past many years, which will tee up our next conversation.
All right. So I would say that obviously the Oslo Accord, as you said, has limited the expansion of those kind of efforts beyond Area C. Not completely. We will dive into it in a bit when we'll start talking about what they're planning ahead. But basically, most of the thing that I talked about before in terms of how they're pushing forward annexation happened almost completely in Area C. Right, that control by the Israeli military, both civilian and militarily, which means that the Palestinian Authority had, I wouldn't say complete autonomy because that's just not correct at all, but they had certain autonomies and certain aspects of life, right, civilian mostly, managing the day-to-day life in areas A and B, and also providing services to Palestinians in Area C, right? But I would say that not necessarily because that was a limitation for Israel, but more of like, why would we, govern the Palestinians when we can have like a contractor to do it, right? Like, obviously, the PA is not just a contractor; it's like an entity with its own aspiration and everything. But in terms of like when you look at how that benefits Israel. You know, they don't have to deal with it. They don't have to deal with the daily reality of providing civilian services for Palestinians. They are basically, after the Oslo Accord, kind of turned into the go-between, right? Between what the Palestinian ask in terms of like permits, what we need, like access to land, permits for work, permits to build, whatever, and like the military itself in terms of what will it allow. Terms of security policy, land policy, and so forth, right? Like the civil administration became kind of the go-between instead of the one who actually providing all the services. But Oslo Accord does provide certain limitation in what Israel can and can't do within the West Bank. In terms of it's also beyond like the, you know, bureaucratical ins and out, it also creates a certain normative, right, framework, right, that in the end, hopefully, this area will become a Palestinian state. So it kind of declare that the situation is temporary, right? We are in the in-between stage. Unfortunately, the in-between stage is now like 20 years ongoing,
yeah.
Even more. And I would say that another thing that I wouldn't say was complete deterrence, but deterrence in certain aspect is the Israeli Supreme Court, right? And I believe we'll talk about more when we'll talk about, you know, the judicial overhaul and how it's, you know, very much connected to the annexation policy of the Israeli government. But when you see an attempt, like we had a few years back, of what was called the regularization law, right, that basically attempted to kind of retroactively regularize all the outposts and the illegal building within settlements, the Israeli Supreme Court said, all right, that's too much. Okay. Yeah. Like when we're talking about private lands and when we're talking about like a overhaul of, you know, regularization of illegal building, that is too much. We can do it case to case basis, but not like an overhaul policy.
Yeah. I think what's so interesting is all that you've said, what's happened since Oslo and how Oslo is kind of not limited, but there's a sense of a framework there and licenses some Israeli actions in Area C, and why Israel hasn't yet, for the most part, kind of entered Areas B and A in the same way. That's all happening on the governmental level. Meanwhile, settlers and radical settlers and their ideology are pushing all of these campaigns and all of this public opinion that says Area C is ours. First, it was the settlement blocks. We'll never give up the settlement blocks. And then it's Area C is ours, to where now the annexation of Area C in Israel is like a given. So they've kind of moved on and to the next target, which I'm going to ask you. But what's truly harrowing for those of us watching this is now those radical settlers who for so long have pushed annexation and done the groundwork to normalize this idea and to get government support for this idea. They are the government. They are the government. First and foremost, I want to ask about about Bezalel Smotrich, who has gotten a lot of press, but I want to review who he is, what his powers are, Readers of My Settlement Report, I'm sure, will be very familiar with yes. him and his new powers. So can you please just walk us through that, about what he is, what the settlement administration mm-hmm. is, and
yeah, I'll do my best. Okay. But let's just start with the fact that what we like to call radical is no longer radical. It's the mainstream now, right? Because they are very much part of the government. They're very much part of, you know, the policy making process. So if you want to talk about Smotrich, I think he is probably one of the most outright, like, classic representative of the settlement. Right? Grew up in a settlement. He was, like, the operation director of the Ring of Fame organization, which is very much pushing toward, like, extending Jewish settlements in the time of the disengagement from, you know, Gaza and parts of the West Bank. He was actually arrested in charge to kind of attempt to kind of disrupt this. He is, like, very much, you know, in the core of the ideological movement of what they call the religious Zionism, right? And also we have to remember, it's not just about the West Bank, right? Like, a core part of it is basically that the Jewish people have a right to all part of the land of Israel. But it's also about Israel becoming an halakha state, like a Jewish law state, or a maybe modernized one, but still a Jewish law state, right? Obviously, they are a big supporter of the legal reforms because they are weakening kind of the court and giving more power to the government. And they're also very much, he and, you know, his party, they're against equal rights to the LGBT community and, you know, to the Palestinians within Israel. Like, it's not just about the territories. We have to remember, right? It's much bigger than that. And so when we're talking about Smotrich's power, not just he, but, you know, his whole party got, right? Like, first of all, it was part of the coalition agreements, right? I'm sure, like, you mentioned it before in your podcast, but the coalition agreements before, right, in previous elections, usually were not as detailed as it was this time. They were more like of a declaration of intent and sort of promises that make it. But this time around, there was like a whole detailed work plan that was, you know, laid out in those kind of agreements. And they was very specific in what they promised, including like the implication of sovereignty, Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank, right? Including settlement expansion, including regularization outposts, and also significant changing in the structure of the military governance over the West Bank. Those was the promises that were made within those coalition agreements. And I have to say, they are doing a pretty good job at follow through, right? And I think one of the things that it's very important to understand, and, you know, I keep saying it almost every time that I get to talk with people from the international community, this is not, like, really, a lot of time you used to talk about this in terms of, like, a political power grab, right? People kind of try to have as much power as they can. But we have to remember, this is not about just to have more power. This is about having the political power to implement a very clear ideology, right? It's a very clear, some religious, some, you know, national ideology regarding how the future of Israel needs to look like in terms of not only sovereignty over the West Bank and hopefully, you know, also, you know, returning to some part of Gaza and so forth, but also in terms of of Israel as a Jewish state first, right? And that is something that is very important to remember when we're thinking about what is going on, how is everything is related to each other. Now, we're talking about what Smotrich got. Then not only he is now the Minister of Finance, which is a lot of, like, power and responsibility and, you know, controlling a lot of, like, the funds, who is getting what, he also got the position that is also really weird to say in English, but I'll do my best, but he is, like, the minister within the Ministry of Defense, right? He's not the defense minister, but he is a minister within the ministry. And basically, what he got, like, there was a lot of back and forth around it. Like, it's a little bit different than what he was first promised. But in the agreement that was done between Smotrich and Gallant, which is the Minister of Defense. What they agreed that Smotrich, as his role is the, like the additional minister, if you will, right? He will be responsible to what they call the civilian aspects, right? They have whole, like they have a chart and they have like a whole list of what is considered civilian, what is considered security, right? Smotrich is getting everything that is civilian. He's also going to appoint a deputy to the civil administration that will be a civilian, not a military man, right? He's going to be, and under him, there is what they call the administration, the settlement administration, right? Now, it's kind of confusing in English because settlements mean a lot of things, different things in Israel. It's not necessarily just settlements as we know it, but like the settlement in the sense of like residency, like, you know, expanding residency. But anyway, the point here is that this new administration, right, is going to get a lot of power on issues of building, planning, construction, enforcement within the civil administration. So heritage site, confiscation, demolitions, those kind of things, like things that's considered civilian, right? But it's actually like the day-to-day life. They're going also to lead a reform that is called equal citizenship. It's something that started actually 2014, if I remember correctly, but kind of was folded, but it's going to kind of get renewed. The base premise there is how can we improve the services that settlers get through government offices, basically like privatized, not the right word, but civilize, if you will, the military regime, right? Like everything that the military was responsible is going to be now transferred into government hand, basically very much like aspect of applying sovereignty, if you will, right? And regulating outposts and also expanding the application of Israeli law over settlement through military orders. And then just some of it. Another big aspect that I'm going to mention before like stopping because it was a lot, that and a very important part of it is that the whole what we call legal advisors or legal counsel, right, to the military commander, with every aspect that is now considered civilian, is going to be transferred to this new settlement administration, right? Which basically means that the people who give advice regarding to what is lawful, right, are no longer going to be people who are trained by the military according to international law and their obligation, but are going to be people, civilians, who were, hired or contracted by Smotrich and his people to promote Israeli interests.
Now, are Smotrich's powers limited to Area C? Is there any territorial limitation on him?
Well, currently, yes. They're limited to Area C because of, you know, the Oslo Accord and what they limited the civil administration, right? Basically, what he got was the civilian areas of the civil administration in Kogat. So this was like... Yeah.
So given the... it's quite breathtaking, the transformation that has occurred over the past 6 months and the changes to the governance structure that has now put Bezalel Smotrich... I mean, we call him the de facto sovereign, the governor of...
The governor, for sure. He's the governor.
Yeah. So, I mean, has Israel annexed Area C?
That's a good question, right? Because when you work with people in the legal field, right, everything is complicated, right? And it's always about how you interpret the law. But I would say it's complicated mostly because a lot of what annexation is about official declaration. Without that official declaration, it's kind of hard to kind of say that specific step is what, you know, is now the jure annexation. I would say that, you know, what's happening here obviously causing a very lively debate among, you know, both human rights community and the international law community are like, when can you actually say that annexation happened when you don't have an official, you know, declaration? What is like the criteria? What is the threshold? Right? And for example, one of the claims that I think is actually very, I find a lot of logic in it, that annexation happens when you see changes in the character of the governance of the territory in several levels, right? When you see a change in the declarative level or the policy level, right? And we see in what is the norms or the policy, when you see a change in how the structure of the governance work, and when you see a change in the symbolic level, like who is representing the government in the territory, when all of these happen together, you can say, okay, we probably crossed this threshold. Now, I would say that, you know, as ACRI, like we haven't like been, haven't discussed it and have like an official position. So I can't like speak on the name of ACRI. I can say that in my opinion, even if we haven't maybe, you know, crossed this threshold yet, because certain maybe symbols are not yet like transferred into civilian hands, we are certainly like pushing the line very closely and probably just about to step over.
Yeah, it seems, and this isn't a comment on ACRI or any other legal scholars, I am also not a lawyer, but it does seem like quite just confusing to have to wait for a formal declaration while like it's already happened in practice, but to wait for that formal declaration to be like, aha, annexation. So
it's
okay.
Confusing for us as well. Don't worry. Yeah. Like
you're like, I need to, let's go.
Right, just say it. Say it already.
Yeah. It's yeah. Okay. So I want to move now to not just what the current state is, but where we're going, because it's been alarming. So I have just a general question for you about the current government, Smotrich and others. Like, what is the vision of this government? What does the current judicial reform, how does that relate to annexation? I think there has not been enough, as I said in my intro, there has not been enough attention to one of the underlying motivating factors behind the justice minister and others in passing these anti-democratic judicial reforms is so that annexation can happen. So can you talk to us about that and how diminishing the role of the judiciary relates to annexation?
Yeah, sure. So I think that I started like the current government definitely seeks to kind of accelerate the process of annexation of the West Bank, definitely declared it both in the, you know, basic life guidelines of the government, but also in the coalition agreement, like they want Israeli sovereignty over it. Obviously, they're going to wait for the right moment, right? They're not like, they're savvy politicians. They know that they can't just, you know, go for it whenever. But it's important to remember that weakening the court system, the Israeli court system, one of the goals behind it, right, is to remove certain legal blocks from fulfilling that annexationist policy, right? We talked about the regularization block. That was not possible in, you know, a few years ago. If we'll have the, you know, override clause, for example, that there is an attempt to pass them, then the Knesset can pass that kind of law and the court won't be able to do anything about it. Right.
And that has not been passed yet. The override is different than the reasonableness that
yes.
has already been passed. Okay.
Yes. No. They started like with a big bang and then they understood that maybe they need to kind of step back a little bit, you know, piece by piece. But that is definitely right, like a big motivation, right? If we can pass laws that the court can't like overrule, then we can definitely push forward things that are contradictory to the international law and were prohibited until now, right, by the court. We also have to remember another thing, that till today, right, not always successful, but there were some restraint to the government actions, right, in the territories and the violations of human rights of Palestinians, through the work of both, you know, civil society organization, but also through the legal system, not just the court, but also through, you know, the gatekeepers, right? The people who were like the legal advisors, the people who work in the justice department, people who say, wait, this is a problem. Like, I understand this is your policy, but you can't legally do it, right? Also the court, right? It sometimes says no. But and even though that restraint were, you know, limited, and, you know, we know that we have a lot of criticism about the Israeli court system, but it existed, right? And when you completely do an overhaul of how the regime worked and you suppress the checks and balances system that kind of allow the balance to balance between the power of the government and what is like the public interest, the human rights that are protected and so forth, right? The first one who are going to get hurt are, you know, the weakest communities and, you know, the people with no status, the Palestinians, right? The minorities, because they will have no defenses left. And this is why when you want to kind of push forward a policy that when we started, like you remember talking about Smotrich, the policy, not just about sovereignty, but a policy of like Israel, a Jewish dominance, right? Or Jewish superiority over all the territory, right? And kind of transferring the balance between what is Israel, the democratic Jewish state, and Israel is more of a Jewish state, then you need a weaker court. You need to have more power for the government.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to move quickly through this. But Smotrich has not hidden his agenda. I mean, he published a decisive plan in 2017 that has laid out in detail what he wants the future of the Israeli state to be, and that has no place for Palestinians in it. And I will include links to that and to analysis of Smotrich's plan. But I want to ask you, Smotrich already is not satisfied with the powers that he's been given over Area C. He rejects Oslo, two states, confederation, coexistence. He's against all of these things. Excuse my dog in the background if you can hear him. So I know Smotrich appeared before a, hold on just a second. I will edit that out.
That's fine. I actually think it's charming, you know?
I'm sure they'll get some of it because I can never edit things super seamlessly. But anyways, I'm going to try my best to like, I'm going to scribble down what time it is right now on the clock so I can have a little bit of a clue. 45:10. Well, I'll just do 45. We have like people working on our roof right now, and thank God we haven't been hearing the bang, 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 but now he's like freaking out because I think one of them. Okay. So I am going to pick up again with wherever I was.
Yeah. Go for it.
45:32. All right. So can you just talk to us about how Smotrich is already dissatisfied with the powers that he's been given over Area C and what he's seeking next?
Okay. So what we know so far, right? Again, there is the big plan for Smotrich, and not just Smotrich in general, the big plan for the settlement movements. We can like talk about in a minute, you know, about what like the how their future, how they imagine the future, which is one thing. And there is like the current plan of what's going on, what is the practical step that they're pushing forward in order to kind of expand the control, the Israeli control over Area C, and now also into Area A.
Yes, it expands. This is how, like the
yes,
this is how it expands.
This is the next step.
And not to say that Israel, I think to your point earlier, hasn't been already active in areas A and B. I think, you know, the ongoing military raids that have, I mean, that's defined this year for Palestinians in the West Bank. That is all Area A and all Area B. And I think, you know, another thing I cover regularly is archaeology and how archaeology in the West Bank has been weaponized to allow annexation, de facto annexation, and incursions into areas in Area B specifically. So kind of other things to pay attention to and factor in when we think about how Smotrich's insertion into the government and his role as a de facto governor of the West Bank is ever increasing the scope of annexation and the picture of what the future holds. And
totally. You are completely right. But I would say that another thing to notice, he's also the Minister of Finance, right? Which means that he have a lot of power on the resources that are being allocated to different ministries. And it's not, you know, a coincidence that the Ministry of Infrastructure or Roads, I don't know exactly how to translate it, committed to have a quarter of its budget in the next 10 years, right, allocated to roads and transportation in the West Bank.
But it's not annexation yet.
It's not annexation yet, but we're there.
Yeah. So I have two questions I think are worth concluding with. One is, what is ACRI doing? I mean, ACRI is the preeminent civil rights organization in Israel. What approach are you taking to annexation? What can be done?
Well, I think our approach is, let's say, multilateral, if you will. Like, when we can, we are mostly a legal organization by our core, by nature, but obviously when we're talking about the occupied territory, we always need to kind of shift our strategy a little bit because the situation there is very different. But when we can attack something in the court, we will, right? Like, the regularization law, that is something that we, together with our other organization, like, petition. So obviously, if there will be certain plans or legislation that we will be able to kind of petition against, we will definitely do it. But I would say another big part of our work is also advocacy and information gathering within the Knesset, right? Is to go to those communities and find out what they're trying to do and make sure that everybody knows what they're trying to do. It's all speak out in those committees. And it's also to talk with and work with the very few MKs that were left that, you know, still believe that annexation is wrong. Like, if you watch the discussion that we're talking about in the Foreign Affairs and Security Committee, you saw Gilad Karib there, one of the very last remaining MKs that is a very vocal opponent to annexation and the current policy within the government, right? So we're working with them as well. And of course, when we're talking about the West Bank, Gaza, even East Jerusalem, the occupied territory, the international community is probably has always been an important actor, but is becoming even more so in the current situation when we have less and less power within Israel to change the reality, right? So a lot of the work that we're doing is attempting to kind of communicate to the international, right? What is going on? What is changing? Because when you don't have the official declaration, right? When you don't always have like the, this is our plan, this is what we're going to do. We have to take the day-to-day actions and to kind of portray in a clear way, what do they actually do? I would say that this current government is actually making our job a lot easier in the sense that they outright say what they want to do. Right, and it's become much more easier for the international community to understand where we're heading. But it's also becoming much more harder to stop it.
You have been listening to a recording produced by the Foundation for Middle East Peace featuring Kristen McCarthy and Shira Livni of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. And you can also find us on kkrn.org, all one word, kkrn.org. where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us. And we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.